Okay, we're on.
Very good. I hope everybody's doing well. It's kind of getting a little scary out there again. Numbers seem to be going through the roof. But I guess it's something that we anticipated. I wasn't sure it was going to come to fruition, but it looks like it's been transpiring in front of us. So just
anyway. Maybe this is new business, but I'd love to update the committee on that. And so sure. I can wait until then.
Absolutely. No, that sounds good. Okay. All right. Well, we will start with approving the minutes from our last committee meeting.
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. We will move into the first of our two resolutions and start with resolution 457, approving the execution of a contract for $440,400 with the Resource Center for Accessible Living. May I move for discussion?
I'll move it.
Second?
Sure.
All right. This is for their organizational representative payee program. I don't know if anybody's familiar with it. This is why RCAL is such a hidden gem. And I think a lot of people had questions when we had another resolution in front of us. A few months ago. And just what they provide for the community is really, it's priceless. And the people that work there, you know, are an asset. And this is one of the programs that I'm particularly fond of. Mark, you want me to talk a little bit about it, or you want me to add, or do you want to give a rundown?
I'll do a brief summary, and if you think I missed anything.
Yeah, sure.
So we put this out to RFP every couple years. And basically these individuals oversee the day-to-day living expenses and other needs of adults with developmental disabilities and other things. They have a caseload that they work through, and it could be a minor child or someone that is deemed by adult services not to be able to take care of their own daily needs. And so when DSS provides a payment, whether it be Social Security or anything else like that, the money goes to RCAL, and then RCAL determines the needs of the individual and makes those payments.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's pretty much the program in a nutshell, unless anybody has any other questions about it. No. Yeah, like I said, it's a good one, and they're really good over there. So, all right. If there's no other questions, then all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Very good. Okay, we will move on to resolution 441. Let me see here. I don't have 1 second. Let me bring this up. One second, bear with me. I lost my place here. Oh, this is to receive a grant, right? A federal grant, if I remember correctly, for the it's victim related. Let me see. I lost it in my notes here. If you can bear with me. Unless somebody wants to read
abuse and adult abuse, it's like victim abuse.
It's to receive money.
So right. It's amending the 2020 budget to accept allocation award from the Office of Victim Services for Victims of Crime Act, VOCA, Victim and Witness Assistance Grant Program, Department of Social Services. This partially funds our Family and Children Advocacy Center, FCAC, which is a combination of both social workers and law enforcement agencies that we combine to work on cases of, again, domestic violence, child victims of sexual abuse and serious physical abuse.
Why would we say no to this? You know?
Right. Well, yeah, it's just part of the process.
I know.
No, definitely. Yeah. So, okay. No, I appreciate that. No, I lost my nose for a second. So, is anything else on that? Any questions, comments?
No.
Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Very good. All righty. Well, that's it for resolutions. Mark, you had mentioned maybe you want to give us an update under new business. What's going on?
Yeah, I think it's probably appropriate to start reporting out monthly on kind of COVID and where we're at with this committee, since this is the committee that oversees health.
Sure.
So we're at a point right now where we have more active cases than we've had since April. There's a little bit of something that distorts that, and that's that back in April, we were not good at recovering individuals. So it was not a priority to us. Basically, it wasn't as streamlined by the state then. Now, in order to be considered recovered, you have to go through isolation for 10 days and your most recent 72 hours have to be symptom free without the use of like Tylenol, Advil, anything like that. And if you tell a public health nurse that who is monitoring you every day, then they consider you recovered and you can come out of isolation. Back in March, April, and May, people were going on an active case for months at a time. And because we just did not have the staffing power to focus on that recovery piece. So while back then at the peak, we may have had 1,000 individuals who were active, our numbers on a daily case-by-case basis are actually higher now on a 14-day to 30-day average than they were back then. So I almost think that we're near our peak, essentially, or not near our peak. We're near our past peak, but we're just continuing to rise. What that means when we have 40 to 50 to 60 cases a day is that, you know, we're bringing in 7 contract nurses still from the AccuCare nursing contract agency. We are trying to fill the 3 positions that are state funded, and I believe we'll have 1 filled and we're working on the other 2. But we've had an issue of finding frankly, qualified individuals. In order to be a public health nurse, you have to have a bachelor's of nursing. So we're trying to fill those with a fill as, which would be an LPN, which is a little bit cheaper and can still do the work of case investigations. A day in the life of a public health nurse is really making phone calls to new positives, informing them that they are positive. And it's about an hour-long case investigation to both gather contacts so that contact tracers can then reach out and we can contain the spread of the virus, but also identifying what their needs are from a healthcare perspective, what their symptoms are, and gathering all their other personal information. Like I said, each case takes a case investigator about an hour to both be on the phone and then enter into the system all these other, other information, including the contacts who then state contact tracers will call and quarantine. So as we work through that process, you can see that as the numbers continue to go up, it's harder and harder for us to stay on top of that, even bringing in, you know, having our 7 or 8 health nurses, hopefully 3 others that are by the system, and then continuing to bring on the contract nurses. It's a short way of saying that I don't think we're going to be getting out of that contract nursing contract anytime soon. As these numbers continue to rise, I think we're going to continue to see a need. And we're nearing the threshold that we were last time we came to you. And it's likely that in the near future, we'll be coming back to you to increase that threshold.
Al, you had something? Yep.
Yeah. Mark, is there a relationship right now to the number that we're getting, these positives, which are incredibly high right now? for the amount of testing we're doing now versus the testing we were doing back in April?
So that's part of it. I mean, I think that there was hidden positives back in April, right? Where back then, and we still don't have the full testing capacity that we really need to have to ensure that anybody can get a test. We have the one drive-through site that we work in partnership with Westchester Medical. The Tech City site's been closed now for quite some time. New Vance wanted to move indoors into their urgent care up by the mall. And finding another partner to do a large scale testing site that's drive-through in the winter has been pretty difficult. Like when we started that in April, it was pretty windy and cold. Trying to maintain that through December, January, February is difficult. So even the Grand Street site, we're trying to bring indoors a little bit more. We're going to be providing some offices that are like convex boxes that have heat where the nurses can be, and there'll be some carports so that the nursing staff is mostly indoors except for when they come out and do the test and then they go back in. And that's coming soon.
It's not exactly what I was asking, just to be straight up. What I was getting at is back in April, the county was administering X number of tests per day. Okay. I just read recently where I believe it was SUNY New Paltz was testing 3,000 a day. And that was like last week. We were nowhere near that number back in April. And that's just one school. So what I'm getting at is these numbers are elevated, but are they actually elevated because the disease has gotten worse, or is it actually elevated because now we're realizing the actual number of people who are infected? Yeah, am I making sense?
Yes. So I think, sorry, and I was just long-winded way of getting around to answering your question. I do think that the more you test, the more cases you identify, but there are still people who are ending up, we're back to larger numbers in the hospitals than we were, you know, on average 7 to 10, whereas back in the summer, it was 1 or 2 in both hospitals. We got as high as 13 or 14. As we come out of the Thanksgiving holiday, I think we're going to see the hospitalizations continue to rise. And so hospitalization is a number that it doesn't matter how many you test.
Right.
If your hospitalization, and they're seeing it all through the state. The governor just announced today that he's canceling elective surgeries in Erie County, which is one of the worst areas in the state right now, highest positivity rate. And the rest of the state is probably... I'm not going to say not far behind, but he was signaling that it needs to be something that we're paying attention to. So hospitalizations are up, and we are doing a lot more tests, but we're also, some of that number is we're testing, you know, healthy people, the staff of the long-term care facilities have to be tested on a regular basis. Personal care services have to be tested on a regular basis. The students have to be tested on a regular basis. So I think if you looked at the positivity rate of those who just go in because they have symptoms, it's more relative to what we saw back in May, but we are testing a lot more healthy people as well, which drives those testing numbers way up.
Gotcha.
I had a quick question.
Sure.
I don't know where it's at right now, but I've been hearing about home testing, and I think it was Pfizer or one of the big pharmas doing a lot of work on home tests. Have you thought about how, if home testing becomes kind of more the norm, how will the county deal with numbers for home testing?
Yeah, so when it's really just where the specimen is obtained, because those home tests still have to get packaged up, mailed to a lab. And those labs still have to report those tests to the state. So
okay.
It's like the difference between whether you were swabbed at Rite Aid or swabbed in a hospital or in urgent care.
Got it, thank you.
I have one more question.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's more of a question or slash observation, and it may be totally erroneous, but from my own personal experience, walking around, being around out in the public and stuff, and at work, I work at a hospital. And then my numbers are just arbitrary, but I'm thinking it seems like right now it's like the vast majority of the population in our area specifically seems to be utilizing masks. They seem to be using hand sanitizer and maintaining that social distancing. Yes, they have. There are those few, whatever term you want to put on them, rebels or whatever, but the vast majority of the people are in fact doing what's right. So my question is, and this might be something for Dr. Smith, if masks and sanitizer and social distancing are the answer, why is the number still going up when we have like a 90% or 95% people following the rules?
Sure. I mean, masks help, right? And they definitely help stop the spread of the disease, but it's not 100% protection. So, I mean, I've seen a bunch of different illustrations that, and you've probably seen these, Legislator Bruno, where like, if you're wearing the mask, it's like 30% of you getting it. And then if the person who's sick is wearing a mask,
right,
adds an additional layer. So nothing is perfect. And especially, you know, cloth masks and other things, you know, some people do a better job of washing them every day and all these other things. And so it definitely helps stop the spread, but it's not 100%.
Right, but for the numbers to increase exponentially like they are, it almost seems as if nobody's wearing a mask.
Well, I think a lot of that too is not what we see, it's what we don't see and what's going on in people's homes. You know, you have to wear a mask to go to our local Hannaford. You have to, you know, wear a mask to go to certain public places. And you don't have a choice to do that or else they're going to turn you away. What people are doing in their homes and the gatherings that they're having and, you know, the kids that are getting together, you know, I think that they're probably adding a lot or, you know, padding these numbers. Yeah, like I said, it's most likely what we don't see.
It's the social gatherings.
To why it's spreading the way it is.
It's also the group homes where people really can't wear masks as much or don't. I mean, it spreads in those facilities, in the skilled nursing centers. We had one that went from, you know, basically no cases that we knew about to 28 to 46 residents, you know, recently. And so it really, it's like in those kind of congregate care facilities, it's like throwing a spark on kindling and can just get out of control there pretty quickly. A lot of staff work at other facilities. So if one person gets infected at one facility, they may go work at another. But the spike we're seeing now is Halloween and Halloween parties at people's houses. I get sent the pictures from concerned residents that are almost like whistleblowers saying, my kid goes to high school at this high school, and this is pictures of a Halloween party, and it's 30 kids without masks on.
Yeah, that's what we had in Pine Bush. Yeah, there were a number of, and as of recently, my goodness, we had a school board member that had a party. You know, somebody who you think would not only know better, but, you know, be held to a different level and be a little more responsible. And yeah, they had a house full of kids, and that's led to the numbers, I think, in Shangum and in this surrounding area, you know, throughout Pine Bush, and it's crossing over into Orange County and Sullivan County. I live right in the Tri-County area, so yeah, it affected a lot of people. So, yeah, Laura?
I have a money question, because, you know, obviously the millions that were spent were unanticipated at the beginning of this year. What about the upcoming year? I mean, you have three nursing positions that are in the budget, even though one is going to be transferred and be filled by the coordinator? No.
So those three will be, we are taking another supervising public health nurse that we had from a retirement and transferring it. But as far as the fully funded state funding, or actually it was, I think CARES Act funded positions from HRI, we will have those up and running by the beginning of the year. And that'll be for 2 years, fully funding two LPNs and a supervising public health nurse. But again, originally we were trying for public health nurses, and that requires a bachelor's, and we weren't finding people for the salary. While it is going to be anticipated going into 2021, you know, I anticipate that like the AccuCare contract, it will still be 90% funded from FEMA.
It will be, okay. Thank you.
We've hit the threshold to go from 25% to now 10% local share. So while it's not a good thing because we're in the situation we're in, it's a good thing funding-wise.
Thank you, Mark.
I have a question for the committee. Who here is willing to take the vaccine when it becomes available?
I may not have a choice.
Right, yeah.
I have a question for Mark, if I may. Can you give us a little bit of your vision for this position of the COVID coordinator, or what's the actual title?
Yeah, Director of COVID Operations. And so he's in it right now. He's doing it. But on paper, he is my deputy director of IS. It was a position that was open. He has the qualifications for that position too. He did IS work for Lockheed Martin, and in the military, he stood up VoIP and other systems. So operationally, he is very proficient in doing information services infrastructure. He was also a former Navy SEAL and a Navy medic. And so he really understands the world of what this response is, which is essentially emergency response and incident command structure. And so he is our director of COVID operations, technically. I mean, you know, not on paper, but he has been doing the work all year. We meant to include it in the budget. However, we weren't sure if we needed it back in August and September. And now as the cases started to rise and rise, it's pretty clear that COVID's not going anywhere. So we asked Legislator Ronk to carry it. This person oversees our nursing operations and our contact tracers. He oversees our recovery service center, which is our COVID hotline. He works with our school districts and is our single point of contact for public, for health personnel in the districts. He creates reports for them. He will have somewhat of a role in vaccine distribution, although I think that's a little much to add to his plate. So it'll be a ancillary role. We really will have a major role as the local health department in vaccine distribution. In the first round, it'll be healthcare providers. So the hospitals will really take on much of the work early on. But as we start to get through the different phases that the state has put out with essential workers and other things, just like any other vaccine, our public health department has been training with PODS, point of distribution system. And it's basically standing up, you know, when we had a mumps outbreak a few years ago, I think they did like 1500 vaccinations in 2 days. This is a much larger scale and it'll be a much larger operation, but working with other partners like the community health providers and hopefully pharmacies and the hospitals. But we're gonna be the main kind of distribution to get it out to them and do our own pods. And then they will also provide those services in their own facilities. But I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, I've been hearing different sides of the benefits of this position, and I wanted to hear what you had to say about it.
It's an integral position. Honestly, like if it didn't pass, I would need to probably retain him as, you know, the deputy director of IS. But that again, that's another crucial position, and we're losing others from that department that I really one of the reasons for this amendment is so that I can shift and get some leadership back in that IS department.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
And Mark, what's the earliest you anticipate the vaccination being available here in Ulster?
So by the end of this month, early January, we will have potentially our first round four. Once again, that will be for the healthcare workers. And this is the way it's set up by the state, is there's different phases. Realistically, to where we have critical mass and it's available to the greater population, we're probably looking at 6 months before it's kind of fully rolled out. We'll be going through phases. So it's phase one is the healthcare workers, the long-term care workers, and those who are most vulnerable residents of long-term care facilities. That's phase one. Phase two is EMS and other first responders, and I think other vulnerable populations. Phase three is essential workers and continuing on with vulnerable populations. And then you start to get phase four is more of a general population.
Now,
with that, Mark, thanks a lot. I mean, right now you're an encyclopedia of information about the vaccine and COVID. Thanks. But and with that, is there any protocols that are being worked on or put in place? Like once people are vaccinated, this may be coming from Albany for all I know, but let's say, for example, since I'm a healthcare worker, I work at Vassar, and I get vaccinated. And I'm technically, according to what I hear, the Pfizer vaccine is 90 or 95%, 94% effective. Does that say, okay, I no longer have to wear a mask?
Yeah, so I think some of those facilities will make their own determinations. The one thing I'll say is that all of the early vaccine companies that are kind of in the running for the first couple. So Moderna, Pfizer, they're both, they require a booster. I think Moderna is 23 days later, and I think Pfizer is 28 days later. So you'll need two doses.
Right.
I don't know if the hospitals will say, go ahead.
Whatever. Let's say I get the two doses. I'm vaccinated against it, just like I'd be vaccinated against the measles or chickenpox or anything else. That makes me essentially immune to it. And that reduces my ability to spread it to someone else. Am I therefore at that point? I'm just trying to look forward, okay, for the light at the end of the tunnel for the people.
I would think until it's critical mass, there's not gonna be we're not going to see a relief from the mask requirements of the governor, because how do I know if I'm a law enforcement agency or a public health? We have our environmental folks, the environmental services, sanitarians going out to businesses when we receive complaints and they're following up. How do they walk in? And if you are a cook at a pizza kitchen where it's notoriously hot and they have hard time wearing masks because of the heat, how do we know that you've been vaccinated? Are you going to carry a card? So
that's exactly my point.
I think that you'll still see mask mandates until we start to see a critical mass. And then once, you know, the majority of people who want it have been vaccinated, then you'll see those being relaxed.
Definitely. You know, I think Dr. Fauci had mentioned that even subsequent to the vaccination, that they would encourage, if not, continue certain mandates in areas for both mask wearing and social distancing. So it'll probably go on for some time. But another thing that a lot of people aren't mentioning, or what I haven't heard a lot, is that although it's going to be between 90 and 95% effective, it's 100% effective in reducing the severity of the virus when and if somebody contracts it. So that's a good thing.
Does anybody have any other questions on that director? Because I probably won't get a chance to speak to you all prior to the 8th. Does anybody have any other questions on that director of COVID operations? I'm happy to answer anything. I want to reiterate that I think of it as a crucial position.
It's a necessary evil in the times that we're living.
Yeah, I have a question. What's the reporting structure for that position, like above them? And who would report to them?
Yep. So that position reports directly to Dr. Smith, Commissioner of Health. And underneath them are supervising public health nurses and then the public health nurses, which again is about 9 or 10 staff between those. And then they are also overseeing our contract nurses, which on any given day is somewhere between 7 and 5 on the weekends. We have a state school liaison that person directly reports to that director position. We also have a 3-person data team that puts together all of our when we get positives, the way that we're able to report out towns and to the dashboard. That is it's about a 5-hour process every morning. They start at 7 a.m. Because there's a lot of duplicate tests. There's a lot of things in order to get our numbers where we believe they're accurate. Anyway, there's 3 people that work on the data team that report directly to that person. And the Recovery Service Center has a manager, RF Khan, who also reports directly to Dan. They are truly are fully operations, and anything that has to do with COVID is a direct report to Dan. We have another position, which is a director of, it was director of patient services, and it's now director of nursing. Anyway, that person is gonna be point on vaccine distribution. And then as soon as, you know, we're through, this director of COVID operations is 1 year. We're only funding it for 2021. And at that point, Dan and I have already talked, and if there's another place in the county that needs a leader, then and he qualifies for that position, I would look at him for another position. Otherwise, he goes back to consulting work. And the director of patient services would then oversee the nurses, et cetera. I mean, communicable disease is something we have always had. We've just never had to do it to this extent, especially over an 8-month period. 9 months, however many months.
Okay. Does anybody have anything else to bring before the good of the committee? No? Motion to adjourn?
I'll make that motion.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Very good. Okay.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, everyone. Yeah.
Thanks all. Take care.
Be safe.
Stay well.